All right, with those very quick reminders, I think we are getting ready to go ahead and start today's session. So I'm going to ask one of our first speakers, Ashley, if she can call up the presentation materials on her end. And at this point, I'll go ahead and turn the floor to our first speaker, Michelle Burgess, who's joining us here from EPA in the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. So Ashley, once you get your slides up, I'll confirm that we can see them. If we go back to those first slides, we'll turn the floor back over to Michelle. And great, slides look great. So Michelle, feel free to take over.
Hi, hello everyone, and welcome to this exciting webinar. I'm so excited to be here today. Next slide, please. So I am one of the sponsors of these amazing interns that we've received from the Virtual Student Federal Services. Myself, Stuart Walker, Lisa Ratterink, as Jean said, we're in the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, also known as Superfund. And we're also sponsored by John Richards, who's in our Region 4 office, our Atlanta office. Next slide, please. Thank you. So what's the purpose of this? This is actually, we're moving into our third year of this project. I'm very excited for these wonderful interns to bring to you what has been done to date. Basically, what we wanted to do is provide chemical screening levels for evaluating contaminated sites, in particular Superfund sites, with regards to human consuming homegrown foods, such as edible vegetables, fruit, and herbs. Also, part of that is, you know, the uptake of these chemicals into plants and the soil conditions that contribute to this uptake, because integration of urban agriculture into modern city planning has acquired an increased popularity in communities across the states. Ag on this urban scale has proved to be a promising method to increase access to healthy, nutritious, and low-cost produce, as well as you know, just a healthy activity. Furthermore, in urban soils differ from their rural counterparts in terms of their physical and chemical properties, and especially due to the that nature, the soil media used in these gardening plots are highly influenced by past and present anthropogenic activities that can both threaten both soil health and food safety via these chemical contaminants. And so therefore, this work is really important in understanding all of those different factors that go into plant uptake, and then therefore a risk screening value that we can use at our sites. And as you all know, back when the Obamas were in the White House, they put a garden on the White House lawn and everything just exploded and really prompted this particular activity, in that we really wanted to evaluate if it was, you know, basically, can you grow produce in urban environments or in your cities and things of that nature. Next slide, please. So we're very jealous in the chem world of our radiological counterparts. They have a calculator that looks at farmers and resident produce categories. They have 25 subcategories of produce, 23 that are used in their default mode. So they actually have default national scale levels of radionuclides in these particular an uptake into these plants, also mass loading factors that in each subcategory, and they have child and adult ingestion rates for all 25 categories, both for fresh weight and for more typical ingestion rate with cooking and preparation loss. Next slide, please. And so in their calculator, you can choose 3 climate zones, 7 soil types, and also you can put in user site-specific transfer factors if you have that information at your site. So this is what we're really trying to achieve from this particular project. We are currently in our third year of what you'll be presented as the first couple of years of this project, but this is what we're trying to achieve in the chemical world. Just, we have so many chemicals, so many different types of plants that we're looking at, as well as edible herbs and you know, other factors that we're trying to sort out. How can we achieve what the radiological risk assessors have already been able to do in their world for the chemical world? So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Mackenzie and Ashley to tell you more about how things are going with this project. Thank you.
Hi, thank you everyone for joining us today. I want to thank you all on behalf of Mackenzie and I for joining and hearing more about something that we are very passionate about. So today we're going to be talking about our report, the paper that we wrote on evaluating plant uptake pathways of chemical contaminants in state models for risk assessments of contaminated sites. If Kenzie just wants to say a quick hello and introduction.
Hey guys, I'm Kenzie. I'm a co-intern with Ashley.
And so next we're going to talk about the first year project report. So we're on the second year of this report is, and we're actually currently in the process of the third year of this report, which is very exciting. And so the first year report, which you can find at this link here in the slides or on the main homepage for the webinar today, was the comparison of risk assessment parameters for homegrown produce in various models by a fellow EPA intern, Amanda. And the objective of this report was to evaluate the homegrown produce portion of several government-issued international models for assessing the risks from chemicals at contaminated sites. And the report focused on three models with information on how to conduct site-specific chemical risk assessments, which includes human consumption of homegrown produce. So if you're interested in learning more about that report, we encourage you to take a look at that as well. And next, just a little intro on our report. For the second year report, our objectives for this have been evaluating the current state models and parameters used in assessing the plant uptake pathways of chemical contaminants found in urban agricultural scenarios. But so that in order to identify the food exposure risks associated with potentially contaminated urban sites. And our purpose for this is that the EPA receives numerous requests from communities near Superfund sites regarding the safety of eating vegetables, fruits, and herbs grown in those soils. So we are trying to provide the guidance to assist health assessors and EPA risk assessors in answering those frequently asked questions. Because it is critical to better understand and provide better information regarding soil bioavailability and plant uptake to be incorporated into the Superfund human health risk assessment. And now I will turn it over to Mackenzie and Jean as we are ready for a poll.
All right. So Mackenzie, I'm going to swap out the spotlight here. And I think we have a poll question to ask the audience. So I'm going to launch this poll question, and there's going to be a new window that has popped up on the screen for everyone. I'm asking a very basic question. How many years of experience do you have working with risk assessments of contaminated sites? You'll see a series of choices. Simply click the answer, click the circle to the left of the answer that you think best represents you, and then hit the submit button. I can tell who's voted, and it looks like about 3/4 of you have cast your votes in there, but this will help our speakers understand how to present the information in the upcoming presentations if they get a little bit of more background from you. I think I've given you all enough time here to send those votes on in, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll in 3, 2, 1 and share those results. And so it looks like we have a nice distribution. The largest sector, about 40% of our audience, is very experienced. They've been working in this area for more than 10 years, but about 20% of the audience is brand new to the topic. And then again, we do have another about a third or so of the audience, somewhere between 2 to 10 years of experience. So a nice breakdown there. Mackenzie?
All right. So knowing that, we're going to be going over some new risk assessment topics that might be new to you who haven't been doing this for so long, but we'll be sure to go into the details so you can get a grasp on the information. But getting into the meat of things, so over the years, we've seen an increase in urban-based community and personal gardens and the environmental and public health concerns surrounding these gardens due to their close proximity to industrial sites and heavily trafficked roads, like Michelle was mentioning earlier. However, the soil research has primarily focused on forest and agricultural lands rather than urban soils. And so this lack of data is the driving force behind our project. So in order to address these concerns, we began our research by identifying contaminants of emerging concern, or CECs, as I'll be referring to them as, commonly found in urban soils. And we were able to divide those that we identified into two groups, the trace elements and the persistent organic pollutants, or POPs. And here we show that the common sources are of these two groups, some of the common sources of these two groups. And in terms of trace elements, lead seems to have the most sources. And in terms of POPs, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, were the most prevalent in the sources. And with that said, I'm going to go ahead and walk you through each contaminant or contaminant group that's in our comprehensive list of CECs. So starting off with trace metals, this group includes heavy metals and metalloids, which are among the most widely studied soil contaminants. And the metals and metalloids in this category are recognized internationally as a global health issue, making these elements listed here legacy CECs rather than a new issue. So at high concentrations, these act as systemic toxins that can lead to neurotoxic, cardiotoxic, and nephrotoxic effects, and they can enter the human body through ingestion, inhalation, and dermal exposure. And another important note on these is that they're resistant to degradation in biological systems, indicating that they can be potentially toxic to soil biota depending on the concentration and duration of exposure. And this category is additionally split into essential and non-essential metals and metalloids. So the essentials function as protein cofactors in biological processes and are considered non-toxic in trace amounts, whereas the non-essentials have no biological function and are considered toxic in trace amounts. And now let's go ahead and hop into the POPs. And as their name suggests, POPs are toxic organic chemicals that persist in both the environment and the human body. And the main concern with POPs is based on their ability to bioaccumulate and be transferred across food chains. So the first compounds we have under the POPs list are petroleum products. These can consist of two main groups, the monoaromatic hydrocarbons, or the MAHs, and the polyaromatic hydrocarbons, or the PAHs. The MAHs are comprised of four volatile organic compounds known as the BTEX compounds, and these are benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene. And acute exposure to the BTEX compounds can lead to skin and sensory irritation, central nervous system depression, and adverse effects on the respiratory system, whereas prolonged exposure can lead to effects on the kidney, liver, and blood systems. And there are In terms of the PAHs, there are hundreds of known PAHs. However, there are 16 that are known as priority PAHs due to their prevalence and persistence in the environment and toxicity to humans. And the molecular weight of the PAHs can determine soil prevalence. So those with higher molecular weights have poor bioavailability and are more resistant to microbial degradation and typically result in being more carcinogenic and mutagenic. And moving on to dioxins, these are highly toxic byproducts of common manufacturing techniques that can be split into two groups, the polychlorinated dibenzodioxins, or the PCDDs, and the polychlorinated dibenzofurans, or the PCDFs. And this group also contains dioxin-like polychlorinated biphenyls, and exposure to dioxins can lead to cancer, hormone interference, and reproductive, developmental, and immunological effects. And in general, only dioxins with chlorines in the 2, 3, 7, and 8 positions are deemed toxic to human health. So for instance, the most notable dioxin 2, 3, 7, 8, tetrachlorodibenzopyridoxin, or for shorter, TCDD, it belongs to the PCDDs group. And then additionally, out of the 135 identified PCDFs, only 10 are considered toxic. And for the organochlorine pesticides, or the OCPs, these are fat-soluble chlorinated hydrocarbons widely used from the 40s to the 60s, with most uses being banned in the 70s and 80s due to their persistence in the environment. And exposure to OCPs is commonly associated with central nervous system and carcinogenic effects, alongside convulsions, dizziness, nausea, tremors, and slurred speech. And out of all the OCPs, the most notable and prevalent are DDT, chlordane, dieldrin, and aldrin. Now moving on to PCBs and the polybrominated diphenyl ethers, or the PBDEs. PCBs are synthetic chlorinated hydrocarbons consisting of two phenyl groups and varying amounts and locations of chlorines around the rings. And PCBs are known for their widespread presence in the U.S., long-term persistence, bioaccumulative abilities, and high toxicity. And exposure to PCBs can result in adverse effects on the nervous, endocrine, immune, and reproductive systems. And then similar to PCBs, PBDEs are synthetic hydrocarbons with bromines instead of chlorines. And these are widely used in consumer products to decrease product flammability. And because of their structural similarities to PCBs, they reflect many of the same characteristics. And then lastly on our list are the per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. This is an extremely large class of synthetic fluorinated hydrocarbons that are used in stain, grease, and water repellent products, such as firefighting foams and food storage containers. And they're known for their PBT characteristics, meaning that they're extremely persistent, they're bioaccumulative, and they're toxic in small doses. And so health effects vary depending typically on the functional group attached to the fluorinated chain, but commonly are found to cause developmental, immunological, and carcinogenic effects. And of the literal thousands of compounds in this class, PFOS and PFOA are the most widely studied. And more research is starting to emerge on short chain replacements of these banned compounds, such as perfluorobutane sulfonic acid, which is a PFOS replacement, and hexafluoropropylene oxide dimer acid, which is a PFOA replacement. And then having gone through our list, we now want to ask you guys a question. Are there any CECs that we did not mention here that you believe would be useful to add to future research? And you can, if you can think of anything, you can go ahead and type it in the Q&A chat so we can access that later.
And I'll just pause here for just a moment to see if anything starts responding. But I believe that the our speakers here will appreciate any information, even if it's a singular compound, if it is a whole list, if it is links to other data sets or other items that are a bit more robust than just a few compound names. But I do see a number of items coming in here now. It does look like several people are commenting on nanomaterials, microplastics, perchlorate, pharmaceuticals. These are the sort of types of materials that they're recommending. Some are mentioning asbestos, arsenic, starting to see more microplastics, chlorinated solvents like PERC. They're starting to see a lot of residential dry cleaning sites. And we did have one real quick request to go back to that CEC slide just for reference, just to remind them which ones were included. And so if you could keep the CEC slide, we'll see if a few more responses come in. It seems like microplastics is getting a lot of votes here. A number of people are very strongly passionate with the concept of including microplastics. We're looking at industrial compounds, chlorinated solvents like dioxane, PCE, TCE, maybe even explosives, polychlorophenols, again, 1,4-dioxane. So we've got a lot of responses coming in, Mackenzie.
Awesome. All right, so we'll go ahead and move on, but go ahead and keep sending things in the chat if you can think of anything. So moving on, we have our list of CECs that were commonly referenced, but we wanted to identify which CECs were most prevalent in each state. And here we have listed the states that we were able to find information on in terms of prevalence in urban soils, which you can, as you can tell, is harder to find than prevalence in agricultural or forest soils. And in the list, those in blue, we actually only have limited information on. I think you go to the next slide. And now here's a list of states that we did not find information on. And so we want to ask you another question. Are you aware of any articles or information about CECs at urban agricultural sites in the states and regions listed here specifically? And you can go ahead and answer in the Q&A chat as well, either an article title, article link, or if you can't find that information right now, it would be amazing if you could email Ashley and I afterwards with the information. Really anything helps.
Okay, so I'll remind everyone, those responses can come in to the Q&A in response to this most recent request. I'm still seeing answers coming in from your previous question, lots of responses for microplastics. I just need to adequately voice what I'm seeing coming in here. But we are seeing a couple of responses here, and I'll just read through some regarding the second question. One of the attendees noted that you are likely to get more detailed information about Alaska soils by directly contacting the state departments rather than checking through EPA. So just a recommendation to go straight to the state agency. We have another note that if urban information is included, but California recently presented some information on CECs prioritized in that particular site, it was through a webinar. So again, if you have additional details or links, please share that information with us so that our speakers can follow up. Another attendee notes that the University of Delaware has soils info from their soils lab. We also have an attendee who included a link from a, it looks like the state of South Dakota, and it's actually a map that lists every known spill reported to South Dakota, and you can sort based on the city if you want to focus on looking at those urban results. So we're also getting additional links to other cities, such as a soil lead project from Detroit, Michigan. It looks like it might be Indiana has something for lead and arsenic in surface soils in Indianapolis. A couple of textbooks that we're suggesting that might have sections that you can look at. So we are getting a lot of responses. So thank you.
Awesome. And I'll go ahead and pass it back to Ashley.
Perfect. Thank you. And then I will also, I guess, it's time for another poll, Jean, but I also just want to thank everyone for all of the amazing feedback, and please keep typing in the Q&A chat with anything that pops in your head, because we very much appreciate it.
Okay. Well, as you said, it is time for another poll, so I'm going to launch a new one. And ladies and gentlemen, there should be a new pop-up on your screen. If for any reason you don't see this, if you're on a mobile device, sometimes you need to look for a three dots and more button, and then you can manually navigate to the poll. But this question is now asking, how many years of experience do you have working with urban agricultural sites? And you'll see a similar set of answers to select from. If you're brand new or you have a variety of years of experience, just click the circle to the left of the answer that best represents your response and hit that submit button. It does look as though about two-thirds of you have responded. We'll give it just a few more seconds. And again, trying to compare your experience with risk assessments versus your experience in urban agricultural sites. It'll sort of help, again, how to refine additional information we'll be sharing here in the session. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close that poll down now in 3, 2, 1. And it does look as though this is a very new topic. Almost half of the audience, it's brand new to working in an area of urban agricultural sites. We have a small percentage, less than 10%, that have more than 10 years experience. And then again, about 40% have somewhere between 2 to 10 years. But overwhelmingly, it's brand new to the most of the audience.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that feedback. That helps a lot just for the scope of how to go forward in this presentation. We will move on along. So now we're going to be talking about plant uptake of CECs from urban soil. So urban agricultural soils are highly variable chemically and physically at fine geographic scales, reflecting the various management history of individual sites. And as you can see in the two graphs on this slide, that they do differ. And urban soil systems, they differ from the rural counterparts in terms of their physical and chemical properties. And consequently, plant uptake findings from rural agricultural soils do not directly apply for risk assessment of urban soil media. We will be highlighting the environmental factors, plant physiology, and soil characteristics that play a crucial role in the uptake and translocation from soil to plant systems. So first, we're going to start off with the environmental factors. The environmental factors influencing uptake and translocation of contaminants by plant systems can be represented by the evapotranspiration rate, also known as the KC value. The evapotranspiration rate of crop plants is determined by climatic and plant-specific values and is a good indicator for the ability of crop plants to uptake and accumulate contaminants in their tissues. And what we have learned from this is that increased evapotranspiration correlates to increased contaminant uptake. The most common environmental factors include temperature, wind speed, air humidity, the climate of agricultural areas, and soil moisture. As indicated by the plus and minus signs on the table, literature has found that high temperatures, high wind speed, low air humidity, hot and dry climates, and adequate soil moisture content accelerate the evapotranspiration rate of contaminants by plant systems. Moving on to plant physiology. Vascular plant tissue is composed of the xylem and the phloem. And the xylem is a unidirectional transport system for water and minerals, whereas the phloem is a bidirectional transport system for organic molecules. So when water and solutes enter the plant roots through the epidermis, organic contaminants in solution either cross through the root membranes and transport through the vascular pathways to the aerial tissues, or they accumulate in the plant roots. So factors of plant physiology affecting these pathways can be quantified using the bioconcentration factor, which is also known as the BCF. The bioconcentration factor can be used as an indicator of a chemical substance's tendency to accumulate in the plant. This takes into account the plant genotype, the growing season of a specific crop, the overall plant health, evapotranspiration values, net irrigation requirements, and the concentration of lipid content found in the plant roots. The factors shown in the plus column of the table represent the system in which the bioconcentration factor of plants is increased, therefore allowing water and nutrient uptake and photosynthetic efficiency to increase as well. So overall, increasing the plant system's ability to uptake and translocate contaminants. Moving on to soil characteristics, the inherent properties of natural soils, such as the organic matter content, which is known as SOM, the type of soil media, pH, and aerobic versus anaerobic conditions play a critical role in affecting contaminant uptake by plants. An aerobic environment is characterized by the presence of free nitrogen, while an anaerobic environment lacks free oxygen, but may still contain atomic oxygen bound in compounds such as nitrate, nitrite, or even sulfites. So as you can see in this table, the plus and minus indicate that low levels of soil organic matter, sandy soils, acidic pH, and aerated soils, which would be in aerobic conditions, so with lots of free oxygen, tend to produce an increased amount of uptake and translocation of contaminants in plant systems. So moving on to the mechanism of contaminant uptake by plants. Contaminant uptake by plants generally follow two main uptake pathways. So you have extracellular transport, which depends on the nature of the elements only, meaning that the physiological conditions have no effect on uptake rate. And then intracellular transport, which depends on pollutant factors, plant biological characteristics, and environmental media factors. Studies have shown that contaminants are enriched at the root surface and enter the roots with water. This mechanistic step is in agreement with previous literature stating that hydrophilic compounds, or compounds with a higher affinity for water, have a higher uptake rate than hydrophobic compounds, or compounds with a lower affinity for water. Contaminants, they penetrate the roots through the cuticle-free cell walls of young root hairs located closely behind the tip of the root. Contaminants then travel to the xylem transport tissue in the root along free intercellular space or cells. The cell wall of the root cortex is porous, allowing for contaminants to move freely from solution to the interior before they reach the endodermis. And the general approach for examining bioaccumulation of organic chemicals in terrestrial plants includes measuring either root or foliar uptake, depending on the properties of the chemical or the most relevant route of exposure. But it also must be noted that exposure rates may differ depending on consumption of the root or the shoot or the fruit of any given plant, therefore potentially posing different health risks. Further research in this area would allow for a more thorough risk-based assessment that takes into account the varying plant species and their subsequent edible parts. But another actually fun fact about plants is plant systems have what is known as the green liver concept, where plants have enzyme-based mechanisms that can detoxify contaminants that they take up into their systems. But the problem at hand is that the contaminants of emerging concern that we're highlighting today are often lipid or fat soluble, meaning that when the contaminants are taken up and translocated across plant tissues, the green liver concept of plants is unable to detoxify the contaminants. So now moving on to the mechanism of contaminant translocation by plants. The following diagram just details how the factors previously mentioned affect translocation and kind of tie in. So following uptake by plants, pollutants are translocated to different parts of the plant. And generally, two kinds of pollutant transport pathways have been reported: the intracellular and intercellular transport, which are both known as short distance transport, and then another type of transport known as conducting tissue transport, which would be also referred to as long distance transport. So currently, agreement on a formal mechanistic approach for contaminant translocation by plants is not heavily present in literature. We also found that literature focusing specifically on urban soil media translocation was not easily identified. So this is another area of if you think of something now to put it in the Q&A, or to we'll have our contact information at the end of this presentation if you would like to reach out to us. If this is an area, if you have any resources that might help us learn more about this, because this was one area that we highlighted as a little bit of a struggle that needs more research for sure. And now moving on to quantifying the uptake of contaminants of emerging concern across plant species. So by applying the uptake models from urban gardening scenarios, it allows us to quantify the uptake of these contaminants. So fruit vegetables growing under controlled greenhouse conditions, for example, cucumbers, green beans, tomatoes, were found to have higher potential to uptake and accumulate the contaminants of emerging concern in their edible parts compared to plants cultivated in open fields. And this was due to the longer growing and irrigation period, higher net irrigation requirement values, and then water requirements being met solely with irrigation, meaning that no precipitation events occur in protected agriculture. So this was another area to we really dived into, because coming with urban agriculture, it's not always outside and in the environments. Greenhouses are very popular. And so just remembering to include that in the research and seeing what differences the uptake of contaminants can have in a greenhouse setting versus an outdoor urban agricultural setting is something that we would like to continue to research for the next phase of this report as well. So fruit vegetable crops uptake and accumulate CECs based on their reported bioconcentration factor and net irrigation requirement values. And so as you can see, at the bottom of this slide, it shows how that cucumber all the way to the left has the highest likelihood to uptake and accumulate CECs, and then peas all the way on the right would have the lowest. But going on to the next slide, this will have a lot more detail on specific crops. The data presented here indicates that leafy vegetables like lettuce, spinach, cabbage, and celery constitute the crop plants with the highest ability to uptake and accumulate contaminants in their edible tissues. And this conclusion is based on the bioconcentration factor values for the contaminants of emerging concern. So as you can see here, we just separated as the highest potential and the lowest potential. And I definitely think that this slide was the goal of our report, identifying, or one of the biggest goals, identifying what specific crops are at a higher risk. And so if you guys, again, if you have any crops that you have questions about and you say, you know, I don't see this up here and I feel like it, you know, it fits in the same general plant species or family, plant family as some that I see up here, feel free to drop questions in the Q&A or say and comments, anything. This is another area that we are going to continue to expand upon. So this list, well, there's a lot on here. It is definitely not finished. And then moving on to the research gaps. So we'll be highlighting 5 research gaps that we feel are of high importance. And the gaps noted bold are currently being researched during phase 3 of this project. We have hopes to get to all 5 of them, but the ones that are in bold, number 1, 3, and 5, are currently being prioritized in phase 3. So starting off with the first research gap is the state-specific contaminants of emerging concern. As we talked about earlier, our state-specific contaminant list is incomplete. So we do have hopes with all of your guys' amazing input to be able to complete that list, hopefully in this next year. And then the second research gap is the screening standards for urban agricultural sites. There has been limited effort to establish a baseline or screening standards for sites oriented for food production or urban agriculture beyond past EPA projects focused on examining urban agriculture from the lens of contaminated site cleanup or risk-based cleanup standards. Another limitation in this area that we found is that soil testing for contaminants appears to be rare in urban ag settings. Soil testing for agronomic parameters such as pH, organic matter, and cation exchange is commonly done in land-grant university soil testing labs, but this has proved it difficult to provide growers with national or regional specific concentration factor guidelines for possible risk associated with contaminant exposure through produce grown in urban gardens. And the third research gap that we're going to highlight today is that is the state-specific plant uptake models. As I just previously talked about in the mechanism for translocation of the plants, there literature does not agree on a single mechanistic approach that we could find. So we are looking to expand that and also to look more into what states are using. So this is another kind of reach out point where if you know of a state that is using a specific plant uptake model and has found success with it, and this is something that we will also be reaching out to specific state agencies to try to gain more insight on this. But we're hoping to be able to find some trends and maybe even some regional and national trends based off the plant uptake models that are being used in each of the states. And for the next research gap, where we want to look at, along with the US EPA, other various state and or federal agencies with authority to protect food supply, agricultural resources, and public health may have key roles to play in delineating and developing baseline standards for food production. So that is an area that we definitely think should be pursued in more collaboration. And then lastly, the variability in plant uptake and exposure risk across plant species. So fruit trees such as citrus, bananas, and apple, and other fruit-bearing trees have not been sufficiently evaluated in an urban setting to our findings, but it has been shown that they have high evapotranspiration rates, which may render them as plants with moderate to high potential for contaminant uptake, similar to that of fruit vegetables. And with that, that concludes our presentation today. And I just wanted to, again, thank you everyone for joining, and to please contact us with any questions or information you think may help phase three of our project. This is our contact information. I am specifically working on phase three while Mackenzie is moving on to amazing things. So yes, please feel free to reach out to us, and I will hand it back to Jean.
Okay, so we are going to launch into the Q&A segment of today's session. And I know Mackenzie will be here for just a few more moments. So Mackenzie, if you're willing and able and want to come on camera for the few more moments that we have you, I'll put that spotlight back on. And I'll remind the audience that they can continue to submit their questions and comments into the Q&A space. I know that we have a couple of people who joined us a little bit late. So I'll just remind everyone the meeting chat is disabled by design. So if you have questions or comments, references, links, studies, resources, please put those in the Q&A. It is far easier for us to manage those and export them than in the chat, so we use the Q&A for this feature. We did also receive a lot of people asking for copies of the presentation materials, and I'll just remind everybody, we posted the slides on the seminar homepage. So if you weren't here when I have sent it out in a link to everybody, I will resend it, but the slides are available to download, and I'll make sure that you all have an access link for that before we close out today. So with that, let me go ahead and jump right on into some of these questions. One of our first questions came very early on, and that was asking about the term contaminated manure. He wanted to know, how could manure be contaminated?
I guess I can jump in on that question. So manure becomes contaminated from, it has to do with runoff. So say in a lot of rural areas, there might be lakes or ponds or just, you know, any type of precipitation. And so when there are contaminants in the soil, when you mix the water and the contaminants together, and then the manure becomes contaminated. And then that manure is used for fertilization and spread across crop fields. And that is how the contaminants then enter the soil again. So if that hopefully makes sense.
Absolutely. And then there were a few basic definitions, because as we noted, there are people that's brand new to them. So I just wanted to go through a couple of terms that you all use just to confirm. Can you define MAHs?
Yeah, those are the monoaromatic hydrocarbons.
Okay. And then how about NIR?
That is the net irrigation rate.
Okay. All right. Excellent. All right. I'm going to go scroll through here. And there was a request for a link to the full study. It came in, I want to say you guys were about 10 slides in. I'm not sure if they are asking for a link to your report. And if that is the case, I just want to let the audience know that link is available also on the seminar homepage. I will make sure to share that with everyone, but you can download their study. If the question was in reference to a different study that was highlighted by the presenters, the person who submitted this question did it anonymously. So whoever that was, if there was a specific study you were looking to get a link to, if you can send in another message and provide a little bit more context, I'll be happy to try to dig up and get a link to any other studies that might have been referenced. I will let Ashley and Mackenzie, as well as our organizers, know that the audience in general was really excited with all of these resources that people were putting into the Q&A. So the information that's being shared with our speakers and organizers, the audience has asked if that can be made available to them as well. So something for consideration, we could aggregate a list of some of the links and data sources that were included in Q&A responses, and I can post that as a supplemental resource to the webinar archive. So if it's something that the organizers and speakers are open to, I will be happy to work with you to get that, and then we'll let everybody know by email as soon as that our aggregated response is available. So not a promise, but I think we can make that happen to get those resources. It seems like there definitely is interest. Just to confirm, we have some other people who wanted to know, when you were asking about CECs, are you talking about the most common ones or just anyone?
Yeah, we were looking for state-specific, most common CECs, because that's what we were struggling to find. We could find lists of like CECs across the U.S. that were common throughout, but having those state-specific ones would help us a lot.
Okay.
And going off of that, another thing is, yeah, we were able to find a list of sometimes like every contaminant that has been found in that state sometimes, but then we struggled to find what ones that state declared to be a contaminant of emerging concern necessarily. So that was also kind of a hard like information to find, because for even though it is still classified as a contaminant of emerging concern, some states have a higher, you know, arsenic problem or a higher lead problem than other states do. So that was also something that we were hoping to identify.
Okay. We did have a question if you have considered the leaching from structural materials that are used in small-scale urban gardening. So not so much the soil itself, but they say railroad ties, plastic pots, plastic raised bed planks, different types of preserved lumber in and of itself could have materials that then leach into the soil, and they're used to create these urban gardening bins. Have you looked at that or considered that in your study?
It's definitely something that I looked at, but it came down to being slightly outside of the scope of this individual report. It came down to basically there being a lot of information and us having to narrow our scope so that we could give a presentation or report that wasn't 100 pages long. But that is definitely something that I wanted to look into for the next report. So I appreciate the reminder. That is something that I will write a note to look into.
Okay. We have a question regarding slide 22. One of the attendees notes that both dry agricultural areas and adequate soil moisture were provided as factors that affected evapotranspiration. And it seems that, quote, dry agricultural areas would have low soil moisture and vice versa. And they just wanted to know if you could clarify that.
Yes, let me... I've talked about so much, so let me go to my notes so I can actually give you an adequate answer. Okay, so Jean, are you able to repeat the question?
Sure, absolutely. So again, you noted that dry agricultural areas and adequate soil moisture were provided as factors which would affect evapotranspiration. And they say that it seems that a, quote, dry agricultural area would have low soil moisture. And they just wanted to confirm, is that what you meant?
Yeah, so I definitely see the wording on that now looking at it back. Is a little bit, can be a little confusing. But it has more to do the hot slash dry, you know, agricultural areas versus cold continental agriculture areas is more of the overall climate rather than the like individual state of the soil, where adequate soil moisture, you know, can vary more day by day. I guess it comes down to weather versus climate and just how those differ a little bit, if that helps.
Okay. All right. Moving on. It sounds like plants that are well adapted to dry or stressed environments are more likely to uptake more contaminants. So these might be plants that grow in popularity and range due to climate change. And they just wondered how or is climate change factoring into your research?
That is a very good question. Mackenzie and I both can contest to definitely spending hours trying to find the research that could answer that question. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I'm still not sure of. And with climate change, you know, being ever so changing, I'm not sure that anyone is fully sure, but I did consider that and I can see how with climate change, how we might be pushed more in the direction of using those plants for nutrition and for our crops. And then in that scenario, we are going to be faced with the potential of a higher contaminant uptake.
Okay. All right. We have a comment on table 4-3 related to PFAS. So on table 4-3, they suggest a footnote because some PFAS chemicals appear to be more mobile as soil pH increases. I don't know if that's an accurate observation.
In our paper, when we go through, because our paper is divided up similarly to how our presentation is, we actually talk about the soil or like how the soil characteristics influence the different PFAS, because that was something we wanted to take into consideration since it is such a large group. So we do mm-hmm. mention that throughout or in the PFAS section of the paper, but we can definitely add that to the table as well.
Okay. And just regarding uptake into plants, when we're talking about PFAS, someone noted that the structure looks like it will be more easily taken up from contaminated water. Is that something that you found?
I believe in our, going off what Mackenzie said, how we mentioned PFAS specifically for soil in the PFAS section of our report. We also mention it in the soil properties section as well. And if I'm remembering correctly, I believe there is a note about how PFAS has like a higher uptake rate. So I'm not 100% sure if it is related to the water contamination specifically, mm-hmm. but that is something that we do touch on.
Okay. Okay. We have a question. In the research, have you considered the potential contribution from aerial deposition?
I know for some of the contaminants, there was a lot of information about how like the major sources of contamination to plants does come from aerial deposition rather than from coming up from the soils. But we didn't necessarily get too involved on that part, onto the aerial deposition of that yet.
Okay. Okay. All right. A question here about uptake for all CECs relative to greenhouse studies. So the question was the uptake for all CECs uniformly increased in the greenhouse study? So for example, cucumbers and tomatoes, did it increase for metals and dioxins similarly?
That is honestly, I do not know that off the top of my head. I could try to quickly look up the greenhouse study, but I do know that the greenhouse study that is mentioned, I mentioned today, is cited in our paper. So while there are a ton of sources in our paper, I did my best to try and make it where we did in-text citations that you can click a in-paper link and it will bring you to where that is in the very, very long list of citations.
Okay.
So I tried to hopefully make that a little bit more user-friendly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to keep going through here because we have lots of recommendations. So just bear with me, ladies. We do have additional people recommending things to include on your CEC list or other elements, or just clarifying what you did look at versus didn't. So I'm going to try to read through some of those. We had an extension to how valuable some of the research could be. And one of the attendees did note that it's possible that we could look into using crops with the highest potential for CEC uptake as a means to remediate soils. So if you can identify those plants that naturally bind or remove these components from the soils, we could plant them and then essentially use them as little vacuums, suck the contaminants out, right? And then dispose of and not eat the crops, but we use it to remediate. So I just wanted to thank the audience for sort of sharing that this can expand beyond just risk assessment, but also look at other practical uses for the research. We do have a note here that the California DTSC claims that they differentiate between wet or regular and dried lettuce as part of their cleanup calculations for some labs. And so they just note that you might need to clarify which type of lettuce you're using, even though it probably is regular lettuce. It's just a point of distinction for some lab work. Okay. Coming on down here, looks like our next question. Have you considered the use of microbiotic influences on plant uptake of soil contaminants?
Yes, we have. We didn't highlight it a ton in our paper, but it is something that I'm hoping to incorporate more in phase three. We have all the notes on it. We've done a lot of the research. It just didn't make the final cut of this version of the paper, but that is something I'm hoping to expand on more. And I'm glad that it is prevalent enough to be brought up today, because it was something that I wasn't really sure if it had the right prevalence to include on phase three. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. I do want to circle back. I'm scrolling through here. It looks like sort of a general suggestion. There are members of other research teams that are sitting in on this webinar, and they're sort of raising their hands virtually just to let us know that there's crossover interest with their team and your team, because they're working on phytoremediation projects, exactly that type of application where the plants can help remove or destroy contaminants. And so it looks like you're clearly looking at data that would be of direct use to that team. So I do just want to make a note, if you are working on a phyto project and you are excited and you're looking at a good, useful data set, there are others out there, and that might be another output where we can try to connect groups who are working in similar projects. So I encourage you to contact our two presenters, follow up with them directly through email, but I will be passing on these comments from the Q&A to them, but please feel free to reach out to them directly. All right, so I'm going to move over here to a few recommendations that have come in. And these are just different, looks like, plants that they suggest that you look at. So one of our attendees from Hawaii suggests that grain crops like rice, corn, wheat, and oats are especially important when you're looking at CEC uptake, not necessarily because of what they uptake, but because they make up the largest part of the human diet. So proportionately, we might ingest more simply because we consume more of that particular type of a plant. And they did share their contact information if you want to follow up with them. We do have another comment that the brassica family has quite a few species that hyperaccumulate metals and metalloids. And so they note that it might be worth thinking about different groups of plants differently in terms of the contaminants that they can accumulate and then how those contaminants are processed in the plant tissue. Others have suggested things like canola, beans for dried beans like fava beans, berries, strawberries, raspberries, rhubarb, and rye. They suggest that you include those things as well in future researches. So just letting everybody know that there's still many suggestions that are coming in. But we have a quick question here. Have you looked at an EPA ECO-SSL guidance regarding the determination of BAFs? And so they're just wondering, is there an example where you see research serving as the basis of BAFs that have not been representative of urban soils?
Right. I think if I'm understanding that question correctly, yes and no. So we have found a lot of research that is talking about the bioconcentration factor, but I do not, and like Mackenzie can correct me if I'm wrong, I do not believe that we had like a direct EPA source.
Yeah, I believe you're correct. And also, while I'm unmuted, I do have to drop off now, but thank you everybody for your questions and comments. It was great, and thanks for coming.
Absolutely.
Ashley, good luck with the rest of the questions.
All right. So guys, we're going to We're going to carry on. Thank you, Mackenzie. We're going to carry on with some additional Q&A time. And one of the questions or comments that came in was just asking if you have considered adding gardening plants that are associated with indigenous communities. So these are culturally important species as well. So another recommendation for more research. There was also a note that PCBs are not taken up into plant tissue. The less chlorinated PCBs are actually taken up into the plant water rather than the tissue, but the effect on animals or people would be the same. So it's just an observation for PCBs. Okay, I am moving along here with a comment about some additional studies. Actually, let me circle back to this tribal question that came in. We have one attendee who is looking to see if not only recommending on the indigenous or tribal inclusion in future studies, but they specifically wanted to know, are there future plans to include tribal specific risk assessments? There are many other CECs, at least from our tribe in Arizona, Utah, New Mexico areas that have multiple pathways of exposure. And so in this particular session, they didn't hear about the variation of discrepancies on pathways impacted by the current drought, and they wonder what that variation might look like. It looked like in this particular presentation, you had focused on one particular scenario, so they weren't sure if you had considered others or would consider others in the future.
Yeah, so that is actually something that we actually did talk a lot about at the beginning of this report and the planning that went into it. And it is something that we wanted to include and just realized that we needed to kind of create more of like a baseline foundation paper for this report to then stem off from in possibly phase three. So if you would be able to, you know, reach out to us and with any resources of those CECs in Arizona, specifically on tribal lands, that would be incredibly helpful because that is something that I would like to include if we're able to come, like when we have to narrow down, you know, the planning of this next report. So thank you for bringing that up.
Okay. We have a number of people talking about pharmaceuticals and including those in future studies. So I just wanted to share that comment that's coming in here. But this next question, bear with me while I'm scrolling up. So something really seems to have struck a chord with people when you talked about the difference between watermelon and melons falling into different groups in the studies. And following that observation, again, in reference to slide 28, one of the attendees asked, for the plants with the highest potential for CEC uptake, do we know if the CECs are accumulating over time? And is it possible that these CECs are clinging to the outside of the plant and not necessarily accumulating into the edible portions of the plant, for example, like watermelon? Again, they're just trying to figure out why was the watermelon uptake so high and melons like tomatoes and eggplants were lower.
No, that's a wonderful point. That is something that I think does contribute to that because also, yes, for the watermelons and melons, it is very confusing, but their values, I believe, were actually not that different. It's just the paper that we took these sources from, the multiple papers, what they considered high and low and how they divided it up, put watermelons on one end and melons on the other. But interestingly enough, there was I believe it's one of the first things I cite in our paper is a safe urban gardening study by Sarah Lupolt, I believe. And it actually talks about testing the outside of all of these different urban gardening crops, but then comparing it to store-bought and how a lot of, you know, like iron, this had specifically heavily dealt with metals and metalloids. And they found that, you know, it was higher on a lot of the store-bought than it was necessarily on the urban gardening crops. And so that is a very interesting factor we have to include as well, because obviously something in the transportation led to that. And I think that very well might be the case for when it comes to watermelons or melons or anything with any sort of thick rind or covering of the edible plant portion. So that is another research gap, is testing specific edible parts of the plants rather than just the uptake from, say, the roots of a plant, or just testing the outside of the edible crop.
There was a similar or a related comment and question. Do you know of any resources that look at how well people actually wash produce and how much incidental soil and then therefore contaminant ingestion might result from typical produce washing procedures?
Yeah, that's actually, I remember looking at it briefly. I was not, so it's not something I heavily know. But I do know that washing procedures that we currently follow don't do a ton from what I found. And it's actually, to support that, it's actually a study I did in undergrad in my microbiology class, is that we tested them. We like grew obviously some colonies, bacterial colonies from crops or like some apples and other fruits and vegetables pre and post wash, and found no significant statistical difference. And so that is something that I also wanted to kind of look into when it comes to exposure risks and what difference that may have. So that doesn't fully answer that question, I feel like, but partly at least.
Okay. All right. We have a number of individuals who are pointing you to other projects or resources. Several people have pointed us to ITRC teams who are working in an area of CECs. So I just wanted to acknowledge that the group is sharing information from one of our big partners. Again, I'll be making sure to pass all of these links and resources onto the speaker. So thank you. But a question about commercial compost for gardens. Did you look at that or consider that? They note that most of them contain sewage wastes that have toxic and hazardous wastes, including PFAS in there.
Yeah, so that was not something that we were able to find substantial literature on, but it is something that I would generally assume would kind of follow the lines of the contaminated manure. So that is definitely something I think needs to be addressed. Okay. But unfortunately, we just weren't able to find enough resources on it to include it in the paper.
Okay. All right. So we still have so many comments and questions coming in. So you, someone has asked if we could make a whole new issue area on the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN website just to collect all of the resources that are being highlighted. This is absolutely a very popular topic. So I want to thank the audience for sharing that thought, and that these types of sessions do help us gauge where we need to focus and develop new resource areas online. We do have a comment that came in here just about the phytoremediation and using plants to sort of uptake or remove these contaminants. They say, well, there are lots of plants and plenty of tests for those plants and their ability to take up the contaminant. The issue is not so much finding plants that work, but it's the practical way to dispose of the plants once they've removed those contaminants. And so they just pointed that out, that there's just more to finding something that can take the contaminant out. Now what do you do with it now that you've gotten it out? So I wanted to share that comment that came in. Let's see, as I'm scrolling through here, we do have a number of references for BAFs and guidelines where they have been referenced, a number of attachments that talk about BAFs. So again, thank you for sharing those citations and those references. We'll be passing those on to our presenters. Have you considered or factored in marginalized or environmental justice communities when you're looking at considerations of potential exposure and effects? A combination of factors, such as access to high quality gardening soils and amendments, may make those communities particularly vulnerable, at least in terms of exposure. So it's just a point for consideration in the future. Okay, we're starting to get some votes for including radiological materials in future studies. As I'm looking here, bear with me. I'm scrolling down here. Does lead get greenwashed in plants? Do you happen to know what happens to lead in plants?
I do not remember that off the top of my head. I can try and figure that out, but I do.
So
I was like, Michelle.
Yeah, sure. No problem. This is Michelle. So was the question about lead in plants in particular, or I'm sorry.
Yeah, they point blank ask, does lead get greenwashed in plants? And if not, then what do you do with the crop?
I'm sorry, I don't understand what greenwash means.
Okay, well, we'll just ask the participant if you can provide clarification. We'll try to circle back and respond to that question if we can. We do have other recommendations here that it could be helpful to look at common gardening herbs as well as fruits and vegetables for intake in a typical residential gardening situation like basil, parsley, mint. So just that recommendation for future work. And we also have one attendee who's coming from EPA Region 1 in their Brownfields program, and they note that they're leading an ATSDR EPA soils shop team that helps communities with lead screening and best practices for safer urban gardening. So when talking about what is screened prior to using urban properties for urban gardening, so much is tied up in capacity and equity questions when community stakeholders are their own motivators and advocates for urban agriculture. And this can differ from Superfund risk assessor scenarios. So they just note that this is really interesting work and they are happy to share their experiences and what they've done in the urban gardening world and their communities if that will help with your research in the future. So again, connecting more research teams and partners who are working in similar projects. Just want to thank them for sharing their thoughts. Okay. How about, let me read this one. Have you found any studies of urban generated compost COC content? Most urban compost would not meet the National Organic Program standards due to non-organic content, but many communities are giving back compost for free for home use. They note that it might be good to have that data and then recommendations on what to do with that compost.
Yeah, that's not something that we extensively researched really at all. Our compost research was pretty limited just based on not being able to find a ton of information, but that is definitely something that I will make note of.
Okay. And I do want to thank everybody who's chiming in with links to their particular state agency and state data sets. We see all of these links. We're getting names and points of contact. So thank you. I'm seeing a lot of them in there. Let's see. I'm going to go back. We have a number of people just complimenting you on this work. We did have a question that asked if you can or have considered calculating the uptake rate of various CECs to determine quantity, so in milligrams, that would be expected to be removed from soil in each growing season. Have you or can you quantify that type of stuff?
I haven't found specific research that talks about that on a like massive scale. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. There are trillions of papers out there. It feels like when you're trying to sift through them all. So that is definitely something that I have made a note of, and I can revisit it for sure, because I definitely agree that that is something that would be immensely helpful for like a guideline for urban growers.
Okay. A question that came in earlier, just to clarify, do the highest potential and lowest potential uptake lists consider both the BCF and ingestion rates, or just BCF?
Just the BCF.
Okay. All right. And I'm going to scroll through here to see if there are any other questions, and these are not comments or recommendations for data sources. Someone asked if you could define VSFS.
Yes, that is the virtual federal service student intern. So yes,
yeah.
The program. I have to remember. Sometimes I get so used to just saying BSFS.
Gotcha. All right. Let's see. I'm looking at this again. Lots of people asking if you've looked at biosolids or sewage sludge in sources from wastewater treatment plants that can be applied to agricultural fields. They see it with food crops and livestock feed, so they imagine it would have a similar effect in urban garden settings. All right, and I do see an inversion where people are so excited for the data sources that they know are coming in that we're about to give to you. Now they're asking if you have found sources that they could use in their area. So just out of curiosity, do you have any information on urban gardening in Minneapolis or Duluth? Anything there?
Yes, actually. I am from Minnesota, currently reside in basically Minneapolis right now. So yes, I actually do. A lot of it is cited in our paper, but I also have a entire folder of information specifically on that because I graduated from Duluth and now live in Minneapolis. So it is a specific interest to me. So if you would like to leave your contact information or just shoot me an email, I would happily get in contact with you and send that your way.
Okay. All right. We also had another person who's involved in a different project. They worked with a small NGO supporting researchers to study mainly lead and cadmium along roadsides sourced from leaded gasoline, comparing uptake with and without the practice of what they call grow biointensive or a GB gardening protocol. They found that there was a reduction of uptake with the GB protocol in place, which they think is from a double digging method, which ultimately reduced the concentration on the surface. So they shared their director's contact information for more details on this. So again, just noting a research project that's being shared. All right, as I'm scrolling through, back down. Here's the next question. As salt has increased over the years, do you see that impacting plant uptake in urban environments?
That is a really good question. I can't say that I have noticed any specific trends when looking over the data. But again, that does not mean it doesn't exist. Sometimes it's just not highlighted in the certain paper I'm reading. So I unfortunately do not know the answer to that one.
Okay. All right. What I'm scrolling through now, again, is just recommendations of sources or areas to study or things to consider in future research projects or how the communities could be suggested to shift their behavior depending on the data that you're finding. So I think, Ashley, if it's okay, I'll just have you just remind the audience one more time of the types of information you are looking for and how they can reach out to you if they wish to separately, and then we'll walk through some final reminders for today.
Yes. So again, if you have any information on specific contaminants of emerging concern for certain states, I will go back to the slide that shows what states we specifically are missing quite a lot of information from. We did reach out to state risk assessors and we did try reaching out to state agencies and we just didn't have luck hearing back or making that point of contact. So even if you don't know specifically the contaminants, if you have a point of contact that might be more direct than us just cold calling a state agency, I would greatly appreciate that. And also if you have any information on state specific model, plant uptake models, anything of that nature. If you just know what, say it's for the BCF factor, the bioconcentration factor, or any other factors that you know that your office is using to look at contaminants in plants, whether it be in like rural agriculture, not even just urban. That is another area that we would love to hear more. And those are the two main areas that we were seeking out information, but these are also the research gaps that we wanted to focus on. So if you have anything in any of these 5 points that you would like to reach out, or honestly, any information anywhere, no matter how big or small, is greatly appreciated.
All right. And there are more data sources coming in. So I think they have heeded the call. Excellent. I'll just remind everybody that I will work with our organizers to pass these on. And as we can produce a sort of curated list of some of the data sets and studies, or perhaps teams or research projects that are related, we'll try to create a summary document that we can post with the archive for this session. Well, if it is okay with you, Ashley, I think I'll go ahead and take over and walk through a few final reminders, if that's all right. So I'm going to take over a quick screen share. And one of the first things that I want to do is thank you, as well as Mackenzie, for taking time to share your expertise and your work, as well as Michelle for setting the stage for today's presentation. I'll just remind everybody a few quick final reminders. If you joined us a little bit later today, I'll be covering how you can access the materials as well as the student papers that were discussed in just a moment. Some of you were looking for ways to stay on top of information, if there were listservs that will talk about sessions and resources. Well, there is one that I can point you to. I encourage you to visit us and at the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org. We do have a number of free monthly newsletters, one being Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month, and we'll highlight websites, publications, free online webinars like today's session. So I encourage you to sign up for that free newsletter. I will send out the next one on January 1st. And if you think you have a resource that is publicly available that might be of interest to those working in the area of hazardous waste site cleanup, please feel free to send them my way. We're always looking for content that might be good for the next Tech Direct. Also remind everyone that there is a unique seminar homepage. So this URL is shown in red. That seminar homepage is the same place you went when registering for today's session. It's the same place that you would have gone to when you were checking in. It's the same place we included in the reminder emails, and it is the same URL that I just shared in the meeting chat for everyone today. There's a screenshot of what one of these seminar homepages looks like on this particular slide. And I bring this up because we have already posted the presentation materials on that page. We have also posted links to the student papers. So I'll just encourage you to scroll. If you visit that URL and you scroll down, we have various sections that break the information up about the session description, our presenters, the webinar slides, and then references, and then related links. You may find it helpful to scroll up and down and use the plus or minus icons off to the side that will expand or collapse sections. So again, the presentation materials have been posted there along with links to the two student papers that were highlighted. And this will also be the place where we'll try to post a summary document as we work to aggregate all of the data sets that were shared with us today. Now, on that seminar homepage is also a link at the very bottom to our online feedback form. So I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment and fill out that feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. For those of you who wish for a certificate of participation, we will share one with you as soon as you submit your feedback. Please make sure that you properly enter your email address on that form and check the box at the bottom of the seminar feedback form. Again, you'll find that at the bottom of the seminar homepage. When you fill that form out and check the box, as soon as you hit submit, you should have access to a certificate of participation like the one shown on the screen. If you happen to have other people participating at your location, but they didn't register on their own, you simply need to give them the link to the seminar homepage. They can fill that feedback form out on their own and get their own certificate, even though they didn't register individually. So again, I encourage you to share that link with those who might have watched or joined you at your location. Today's session was recorded. We'll be posting an archive on the CLUIN or Cleanup Information Network website on our archive page. It usually takes us about 1 week to post the recordings. And from there, you'll be able to share that recording with other colleagues who might find this useful. If you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow up with our presenters. Again, their contact information was highlighted earlier today. But you can also fill out that seminar feedback form and share your thoughts of the recording and get a participation participation certificate based off of your replay. Simply follow those same instructions, and right about now in the recorded version, there will be a button above my head in the upper right where you can jump right to that feedback form to share your feedback, and then check the box that you replayed the whole recording to get a certificate of participation. So with that, I think we have allowed the audience plenty of time to share their resources. I do want to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy day to join us. Again, I want to thank both of our presenters as well as Michelle for joining us to sort of set the stage. And we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.